Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Jim Stein, your host for New Books in Mathematics. The book under discussion today is Brian Clegg's latest work, The Reality Frame, which covers Einstein's theory of relativity and a whole lot more. Simply as an exposition of Einstein's theories, the book is excellent. It's beautifully organized and delivered with Brian's usual clarity and insight. But what makes the book transcend the usual work on this subject is that Brian looks at relativity as a concept that can help us understand what distinguishes humanity as a species and where our species fits into the universe. Brian, welcome again to the show.
Thanks, Jim. It's a pleasure.
The subtitle of the book is Relativity and Our Place in the Universe. How do you go about the task of weaving the two together?
I think that having a good grasp of relativity helps us, if you like, establish where we stand. Historically, I think we tended to think of ourselves as being too important, the center of the universe. But since the scientific revolution, science has pushed us the other way, emphasizing how insignificant we are. And I think when you look at our position, making realistic comparisons, which is what relativity is about, we've actually done remarkably well.
Yeah, I think we have done remarkably well, given that we've only had 180,000 years to work at it as a species, and maybe only 5,000 years when we actually did any science. But let's get to the science. The incident with Galileo throwing a key into the air while on a moving boat shows that relativity as a concept goes back to the 17th century and maybe even earlier.
Yeah, what Galileo was aware of is that it's meaningless to talk of movement without saying what you're moving with respect to. And that's really what relativity is about.
Anyway, that brings up the concept of what exactly is a frame of reference.
Indeed, when you see things relativistically, you need to establish what your position is relative to the thing you're observing. And the frame of reference is the context in which you see something. So, for instance, a familiar argument from history is whether the Earth goes around the sun or the sun goes around the Earth. And when we say that the Earth goes around the sun, that's looking from an external frame of reference, which is very sensible when you're thinking about orbits. But there's nothing wrong, actually, with using the frame of reference of the Earth's surface, the traditional way of saying the sun rises and sets, as long as we're aware of that's what we're doing. If I'm sat on a train, the train isn't moving as far as I'm concerned. It's the world that's moving backwards around us. It's really a matter of how you look at things, and that's really important in physics to get things right.
Yeah, I seem to recall that Ernst Mach was involved in a discussion of that particular thing, but that was a part of physics that I didn't really understand too well. So I'm glad I had an opportunity to read your book. And speaking of which, why and how should relativity be included in the educational curriculum? How do you believe relativity transcends its usual place in the physical sciences?
It's really just because relativity is about how we see things. And it's very easy to assume that our own frame of reference is the only valid one. But in so many things, whether you're talking politics or religion, as much as the sciences, having a grasp of relativity is essential to get an effective view. So, one viewpoint is not necessarily the only viewpoint, is one of the things relativity teaches us.
Yeah, and that's a lesson we could be learning on a lot of different fronts today. One of the things that you do in your book is that you create what you call a toy universe. How does that provide a unifying theme for various sections of your book?
Well, I just thought trying to come at it a little bit differently, it'd be a good idea to build this model of universe, adding in various components so we can see how relativity comes into our understanding. Or for that matter, how it doesn't. So if you start with absolutely nothing at all, totally empty space, there can't be any relativity because there is no frame of reference. I can't measure something with respect to anything else. It's only when we start adding things in and building up that universe, we can see relativity starting to be important.
You know, one of the things that you do is the first thing that you put in your toy universe, as I recall, was space. And how has the concept of space evolved over time?
I think it's fair to say a lot of the development of science has been about moving from taking an absolute viewpoint to a relative one. And that's certainly true of space. So, for instance, Newton spoke about there being absolute space and absolute time. But we now know that relativity plays an essential part. So that when we're moving or under the influence of gravity, for instance, space and time are modified. So we no longer see them as an absolute, but something where we always have to take into account what is our frame of reference? How are we looking at them?
One of the things that intrigued me was that was Steven Weinberg's idea of the ultimate textbook, because, of course, I've always wanted to write the ultimate textbook, at least in mathematics. So what is Steven Weinberg's idea of this?
Well, I interviewed Steven, who's a physics Nobel Prize winner, a while ago, and he talked about this idea of there being a future where a textbook could be written, where chapter one set out all the basic rules of how the universe works. And you could then carry on to build everything on that. And he believed that once that's written, it's not that science is finished, it's over, because there's always lots of detail to fill in. But he believes that in principle, it's possible. To be honest, I'm more doubtful. Scientists often forget that they're creating models. And I'm with the old philosopher, Immanuel Kant, who basically said we can't ever know reality. We can only know what our senses tell us, which isn't quite the same thing.
One of the things that also you talk about is the role of constants, and that was interest to me because I wrote a book on constants in science. And what role do constants play in the construction of the universe?
Well, in the end, I think constants are essential to be able to work things out and have anything that really approximates to a sense of order. If you imagine, for example, that the speed of light was constantly varying, it wouldn't just mess up any measurements based on, the time light takes to cover distances, so we're looking at into space. But there would be all sorts of oddities because constants like this are at the heart of how reality works, if you like. So, for instance, light, the speed of light is involved in the relationship between energy and matter. We both struggle to do science because nothing would ever stay fixed, but also, frankly, to exist if the constants were going all over the place.
Yeah, we can get back. We can sort of get to that again when we discuss the idea of the anthropic universe. But I'm trying to continue through your book in the sequence in which it was written, rather than darting around, which one is always tempted to do when covering topics like this. You next discuss the idea of the Standard Model, which has been, you know, maybe the high point of physics in the last quarter century. What is it? I realize you can't explain exactly what it is, but what basically is the Standard Model and why may it need modification?
There are actually a number of things that are called the Standard Model, but the one we're talking about here is the Standard Model of Particle Physics, which identifies the basic fundamental particles that make things up and the forces that hold things together or make things happen. It's traditional to think of that really as the, you know, the center of how everything works. But in the end, we have, for example, this concept of dark matter, of stuff that's out there that doesn't behave like ordinary matter, which current theory suggests there's about five times as much as ordinary matter. And that, at the moment, does not sensibly fit with the Standard Model. And there are other issues as well. For instance, if we try to incorporate gravity into the model, which currently stands alone. So there's no doubt that it's really good for the bits it works for, but we also know there's quite a lot of stuff out there that it isn't explaining.
Yeah. One of the things that you did later on in your book is you gave one of my favorite examples from physics about when Max Planck decided to study physics, and he talked to a famous physicist of the time, and the physicist advised him to do something else, as basically everything was known except the values of the constants to one more decimal place. And I think one of the things that relativity does, and that you pointed out earlier in this talk, is it points out that there's so much that we don't know. And that, you know, the quest of physics, I don't know whether Steven Weinberg's ultimate textbook will ever be written, but the even then, as you mentioned, the quest of science is not yet done by a long shot.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And, you know, Philip von Jolly, this physics professor, actually said to Max Planck he probably ought to play the piano professionally instead because he was a great pianist. But actually, the fact is that he was able to totally transform physics. And this is going to happen again. We're certainly nowhere near that textbook yet.
Yeah. Now let's get on to something beyond space. What are the wave and particle theories of light, and how were they resolved?
Well, for a long time, there were good arguments for light being either a wave or a stream of particles. So Newton, for instance, thought it was a stream of particles. And the great thing about that is it can go across empty space, because we know light comes to us from the sun and the stars across empty space. And waves usually have to have something to wave in. You know, if you think waves in water, you take the water away, you can't have a wave left. And similarly, ordinary waves don't work in empty space. And on the other hand, light has some behaviors like interference, where two sources of light interact with each other that behave just like the way waves do. So there was theory suggesting that both were the possibility. And quantum physics, emerging in the early 20th century, established that light could behave as both, but not at the same time. But what we have to remember always is that these are models. Light is light. These are ways of describing it. But really, we're not saying light is a wave or light is a particle, but they're good models for describing how it behaves.
Yeah, and they're also great models for enabling us to do predictions and build things corresponding to those predictions.
Yeah, that's right. And the same applies to the most modern approach, I guess, which is fields. You know, if you talk to a physicist these days, they'll talk about light being an excitation in the quantum field. And that's a field is a bit of a difficult concept, really, but it's a bit like a contour map on a scale of 1 to 1. It's something that spreads through all the space and has a value at every place in space. And again, it's a great model. It's probably the best one, actually, for describing how many things behave, but it is still a model.
I'm wondering, do you think the field concept originated with Faraday and the description of his description of the way magnetic forces behaved around a magnet, or did it possibly go earlier than that?
I think Faraday certainly was the one who very much brought it to the center of attention, so that then when Maxwell was working after him, he was inspired by Faraday. Faraday was in no way, you know, a modern scientist, a modern physicist. He was mathematically had very little experience at all, but he had a great grasp for sort of like the feeling of reality, the feeling of nature. And this idea of a field was something he put together to describe how magnetism works. And it's really been extended from there to develop this concept of quantum fields that we use today.
You alluded earlier to dark matter and the fact that it would be used to, it's one of the things that has to be taken into account when we modify the standard model. What problems does dark matter solve?
Well, it dates back to the 30s when they an astronomer called Fritz Zwicky was the first to notice that there was something weird about the way that clusters of galaxies moved around. Because basically, pretty well everything in the universe spins. And when something spins around, if it spins too fast, bits fly off it because the force holding it together isn't strong enough to keep things in. And he noticed, and later on other astronomers, notably Vera Rubin, noticed that things out in space, particularly galaxies, are rotating so fast that bits should be flying off them. There's not enough stuff in them to hold it together. And so they conjectured that there was some extra stuff, some extra materials out there that's holding it together, something that's influenced by gravity but isn't affected by electromagnetism. So we can't see it, we can't touch it, but it has this gravitational effect that holds the galaxies together. And if it does exist, then, as I say, there's probably about five times as much of it out there as there is ordinary matter.
Yeah, and it's amazing that here the universe is five times as much dark matter as it is ordinary matter, and we haven't managed to detect it yet. We just, you know, we're pretty sure that it exists. And that's something that has happened in science throughout history, is that we're pretty sure that something exists because it fits in with our models. I'm thinking, for instance, of the periodic table in chemistry and Mendeleev's projection of the existence of unknown elements. But that's one of the beauties of science that has always fascinated me, is that there are all these areas such as, you know, the periodic table, prediction of planets simply because we know how they perturb the orbits, prediction of planets outside the solar system. It's just an incredible tribute to the power of science that we can make predictions based on what we know, and later we find out that those predictions are for the most part true.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very much how science works, and what distinguishes is the scientific method from some of the other ways of looking at the world is that if it's not making predictions that we can test, it probably isn't really science. And that's really what science is about, is looking at the world, developing a model of how it's working, making predictions from that, and seeing how it works out.
You know, there was a great example in your book that I absolutely loved. Why can we sit on a chair when most of it is empty space?
We don't really think about it because when you look at a chair, it looks solid. But actually, the vast majority of atoms is just empty space. And there is really no reason, were it not for this one effect, that you wouldn't just fall straight through a chair. And the reason is electromagnetism. It's the same thing that makes electricity and magnets work. But basically, there are electrically charged particles in the chair. There's electrically charged particles in you. They repel each other. And so almost what you could say is you kind of float an incredibly tiny distance above the chair. It's the chair repelling you rather than you actually physically sitting on it.
I know, and we feel the chair, but but I like that idea because I'd never really heard it discussed precisely that way. But yes, we do float some incredibly small fraction above it because of the repulsion effect of the electromagnetic field. And the next thing on the agenda that I think is very important is how time enters into your construction of the toy universe. What are some of the ways that we explain time?
I think the important thing is to think about what it does for us. Time's one of those things that's really difficult to get your head around. And that's been the case, you know, for centuries. But there's a couple of things I think we do it. With it, one obvious thing is what we measure with clocks. You could also say that, for instance, it's the thing that stops everything happening at once.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite comments.
Yep. And an important way to look at it in terms of the practical way we use time is it's a kind of coordinate system we use it with it to identify events. So if I'm going to meet you, there's no point me saying to you, I'll meet you outside the town hall if I don't also specify a coordinate in time. And when we do that, it is always relative to something. We tend to think of dates and times of kind of being absolute, but we just happen to have established a coordinate system that started at year one at a particular point, and we're now at year 2017. But the fact is, it is a relative measurement to a coordinate system.
How did Einstein describe subjective time? He had a very intriguing way of doing that.
Yeah, there was a bit of humor, I think it's fair to say. He actually claimed to have done an experiment, which I don't think he ever did practically in his life.
It was one of those thought experiments.
Yeah, well, when he claimed it, he actually did it with the actress Paulette Goddard, but I don't think it's strictly true. What he said was, when a man sits with a pretty girl for an hour, it seems like a minute, but let him sit on a hot stove for a minute, and it's longer than any hour. That's relativity. Now, what he didn't mean is, that's my theory of relativity. What he meant is, subjectively speaking, when you think about time, we see it as a very variable thing. We see it, you know, depending upon what we're doing, it can fly past, or it can go very slowly.
Is there such a concept as the end of time?
It's possible, just as it can have a beginning. I think the simplest way of thinking of it is, for instance, if you imagine a universe that's running down, as far as we're aware, the universe is basically running down, so that eventually everything becomes more spread out, lower and lower energy, until there's nothing measurable happening. You could argue that time is no longer meaningful because there's nothing to measure it relative to. You know, if nothing's changing, how can you tell there is such a thing as time? Philosophically, it might still exist, but practically speaking, it isn't measurable.
That's a good way to put it. Philosophically, it certainly still exists, because I'm sure we've all gone through periods where just immensely bored, nothing seems to be happening, but nonetheless, time is still ticking away. One of the things that you get into next is one of the most difficult experiments or ideas to understand, and that's the example of Newton's bucket.
Yeah, he was using this to point out something odd about rotation in terms of relativity. His idea was to look at a bucket that's spinning around the way the water sort of goes up to the edge. But I think in some ways it's easier to think of the way we get dizzy when we spin around it, which is a similar kind of effect, but it's something we experience much more often than spinning buckets. And the question then is, what is our frame of reference that we're spinning in? Because you get dizzy if you're in space spinning around just as much as you do on Earth. What are you spinning with respect to? It's not like moving through space. It's harder to say just what you're spinning with respect to. And some have suggested that, in fact, the Ernst Mach that you mentioned, that it's the whole universe that you're spinning with respect to. And if you could stay still and spin the whole universe around you, you'd still get dizzy. Though, as Richard Feynman, the great American physicist, pointed out, frankly, no one has a clue because nobody knows how to spin the whole universe around. But the fact is, it's a puzzle in some ways as to how we know we're spinning when we don't have an obvious frame of reference for measurement.
Spinning, angular motion, is one of the most difficult concepts in physics. I found when I was taking physics, one of the reasons that I segued into mathematics, because some of you pointed out earlier that Faraday was a great physicist, even though he had no mathematics, but he had an intimate sense of reality. For me, I was never a great mathematician, but my ability to make the connection between the mathematics and and reality was not what it should have been for a physicist. But I've always enjoyed reading about physicists and physics, and that's one of the reasons that I was so eager to read your book, especially when you started discussing Einstein's theories of relativity. So what are some of the key features of Einstein's theory of special relativity?
Well, it's his special theory of relativity, because it's a theory that's special rather than the relativity, is essentially looking at frames of reference where there isn't acceleration. So it's special in the case that it's limited. It's talking about a special case. And what he discovered from putting together two very simple things, one, Newton's laws of motion, and secondly, the discovery that light travels at the same speed, whatever rate you move with respect to it. When you put those two things together, he discovered some quite remarkable things. So that, for instance, if you see something that's moving, then from your viewpoint, its time slows down, it squashes up in the direction it's moving in, and also its mass increases. And these aren't just subjective things. This is for real. So the time literally is running slower. If you could see a clock on a fast-moving spaceship, it would be running slower. It's not just an effect. It actually is happening.
You know, one of the things that's sort of interesting is when you read science magazines is you read how much our ability to measure these things has improved. And I remember in the early 1960s or sometime in the 1960s, there was an experiment where they took two atomic clocks, put one on a jet plane, sent it around the Earth and kept the other one on the Earth. And that was confirmation of Einstein's theory. But it's also true, somebody once mentioned, that if you're running, because your head is a little further away from the center of the Earth, time is moving more slowly for your head than for your feet. And they've actually gotten measurements that pretty much confirm that, which just goes to show how incredibly accurate our ability to measure things has improved over the years.
Yeah, that's right. And another obvious example is the GPS satellites, the satellite navigation satellites, which have to be corrected, in fact, both for the special theory of relativity and the general theory of relativity, both of which have an effect on the passage of time, because there are basically very accurate clocks that are sending out a time signal all the time. And if we didn't correct for relativity, it's been estimated that your position would drift by a few miles a day. They would get that far out if they weren't corrected.
Yeah, it's amazing. One of the things about the theory of relativity is that it introduces from some very bizarre situations, and one of them is the twins paradox. Could you explain the twins paradox and how it's resolved?
Yeah, I mean, it really is the same thing as your atomic clocks, but done in a more dramatic way. So the idea is you get yourself a pair of twins, you put one on the spaceship and send her off at high speed. For a number of years, close to the speed of light. And when she comes back, let's say when they set off, both the twins were 21, the twin on the ship might be, say, 25, and she'll come back and find her brother on the Earth is now 40, is much older. Because basically the time is running so much slower on the spaceship than it is on the Earth that by the time she gets back, she's actually a lot younger than her twin. You know, there's no question at all of this working. It definitely does work. There's no quite problem with it. It has been demonstrated. And the only trouble with making it work on any significant level is you have to go fairly close to the speed of light, which is not a trivial thing to do.
Yeah. And speaking of the speed of light, easily the most recognizable equation in the world is Einstein's equation E equals mc squared. What did that reveal?
This actually came out of the special theory of relativity. In fact, he had an amazing year in 1905 where he produced several papers, one of which was the special theory of relativity. Another was the one that won him the Nobel Prize. But yet another was an addendum to the theory of relativity that showed that there was an equivalence between energy and mass. So it was basically saying you could relate energy and mass, that stuff, the mass of matter, could be converted into energy, energy could be converted into matter. And you've got in there that c squared, which is the speed of light squared, which is a very big number. So there's a huge amount of energy tied up in matter, which is why nuclear power, for instance, is so incredibly powerful.
You know, one of the things that was pointed out, or at least emphasized, when Einstein's theory of general relativity was confirmed, is that this was a giant step beyond the way Newton viewed the universe. How did Newton perceive gravitation?
Well, he tried as much as possible not to put forward a theory for how it worked, just to give a mathematical description, and a very good one, very close to what's real, of the numerical values, so how much force there is attracting two bodies. All he could really say is that things with mass attracted each other. Now, this is something we say quite happily these days. You know, you talk about a magnet attracting something, or gravitational attraction. But back then, the word attraction really just meant you know, you found somebody else attractive. So when he said, for instance, you know, the Earth attracts the Moon, he seemed to be saying that they fancied each other. And some of his opponents actually described this as being occult, not meaning sort of black magic, but just hidden, secretive. There's no really obvious reason. Whereas what Einstein did was both to improve the mathematics, but also to find a reason why the gravity actually had its effect.
Yeah, one of the things that characterizes Einstein's theory of general relativity, or at least I think, is the principle of equivalence. What is it and why is it so important?
Yeah, he actually referred this as his happiest thought. He said he was sitting in a chair in the Swiss patent office, because this came to him before he was a working scientist. And he had this thought that if you're free-falling, so for instance, if you're in a lift and it just falls under the pull of gravity, then you would not feel gravity. And we know this works because if you look, for instance, at the International Space Station, it is falling, and that's why people float about. The strength of gravity up there is actually about 90% of the strength on Earth's surface. But because it's falling, people just float around. They don't feel the gravity. Luckily, it's also going sideways, so it's falling and missing, which is what being in That's what being in an orbit is all about. So what Einstein was saying is acceleration and gravity were not just similar, but were totally equivalent, indistinguishable, the same thing in effect. And that really was the inspiration to then start thinking about how does gravity affect things? How do things with mass cause other things to move differently?
How does the math of general relativity differ from the math of special relativity?
I guess the simple answer is it's an awful lot more complicated. Einstein was an okay mathematician. It wasn't really his specialty. And where the math of the special theory is something that, frankly, anybody studying maths at high school level, frankly, can understand. It really isn't complicated. You don't even need calculus or anything like that. The mathematics of general relativity is much more sophisticated because it's talking about curved space. It's talking about really quite complicated theories. And also, it has within it not just a couple of equations, but many equations that have to be combined together. So it is much, much harder to deal with. And you can't just sort of solve it generally. It usually has to be solved for a very specific case.
I remember that one of the most impressive feats that I ever heard of in my life was performed by a German physicist during World War I. He got a copy of Einstein's theory of general relativity, read it, and found a solution to it while he was on the battlefield, or at least involved in taking part in World War I. And how you can do mathematics of complexity under those circumstances is absolutely beyond me.
That's right. Yeah, he was called Schwarzschild, and essentially, it was the he made the solution that would lead to the idea of black holes eventually, and it was pretty much on the battlefield, indeed.
Yeah, black holes are one of the ways that we test the theory of relativity, I think. Are there others?
Absolutely. I mean, the most recent and interesting one, I guess, is gravitational waves, where there was quite a big, I think, media coverage when it was announced in early 2016 that the previous year they'd been detected. And this was something that Einstein predicted way back in 1916. Although, funnily enough, a lot of the media coverage said that what had happened proved Einstein right. In some ways it did, because it was yet more confirmation of general relativity, although, frankly, we were pretty certain about it already. But actually, in a way, it proved him wrong, because he always said gravitational waves should exist, but we will never detect them because they are going to be so weak. And they are incredibly weak. It's an amazing bit of science that they did detect them. But what it makes us able to do is produce a breakthrough in astronomy, arguably the first big new way of observing the universe since telescopes. And it's given us already the first direct detection of black holes. Beforehand, we've only ever seen indirectly the things that black holes affect around them, where this is directly detecting a wave that's coming from a pair of black holes.
Yeah, it's just amazing. We live in amazing times, no question about that. What do you consider to be the essential steps in getting from your toy universe to one that contains us?
Well, I must admit, I didn't really intend to go all the way and build one for real. Like all models, it's very simplified. But I thought it was important to go beyond just the basic remit of physics, because relativity doesn't stop there. And so I do go on to talk about how it influences life and how our creativity as humanity has shaped our existence.
And I remember when I was in high school, the Miller-Urey experiment took place, and it was a subject of the media coverage for science back then, because we found out about it even while I was in high school. What was the Miller-Urey experiment, and what does it tell us about the origin of life?
Well, in some ways, not a lot, because the ideas behind it have been partially proved to be incorrect. But the idea was very interesting. What they tried to do was recreate what things were like when life first formed on Earth. So we're talking about putting in some chemical mix that they thought was the way the atmosphere was. That was one of the problems. It's actually they were wrong in the early days. And then sending electricity through it to simulate the stimulus of lightning. And what it did do is to produce some of, if you like, the building blocks of life, some simple organic materials which are used to build the proteins, which is essential for life. But there's an awful long way to go from getting those little building blocks. It's a bit like sort of, you know, assembling a bag of screws and shaking it about and hoping you're going to get a car out of it. It's not going to happen. You need a little bit more going on.
Nice way to put it. One of the great conflicts that you would have thought would have been resolved by now, but hasn't been, at least in the United States and probably throughout other areas of the world, is the eventual resolution between the theories of evolution and of intelligent design. This is one of the ways in which your book differs from standard theories of relativity. You discuss topics that are controversial and topics that deal with things just beyond the basic science that Einstein created. So what do you see as the eventual resolution between these two theories?
Well, one of the reasons I have to bring it in is partly because I'm talking about life, but also because evolution is a very relativistic theory. It's all about how we are relative to our environment. And frankly, it's so beautifully simple and impossible to avoid that I think the only strange thing about evolution is that it wasn't discovered 2,000 years ago. It just is, in the end, is a very simple, straightforward thing that if you can change, if you can pass that change on to your offspring and you can be affected by your environment, then the chances are over time you're going to become a species that is better in that particular environment. And frankly, from a scientific viewpoint, I don't think there is any conflict. The fact is evolution is totally accepted. Intelligent design is really a way of trying to pick at the edges of evolution, to try to find things that are difficult to explain. And the fact is, evolution, you know, explains a lot of things. It's not going to explain everything. There are various other things that add in to the way that living things have developed. It's not just about literally natural selection. The fact is, though, that evolution is absolutely solid scientifically. Intelligent design is, as yet, as far as I can see, unnecessary.
Yeah, I think it's unnecessary, too. And I think that's the viewpoint of most people who are scientists, even, you know, even scientists. I know a number of scientists who are deeply religious. Many scientists have been throughout throughout history, and they don't necessarily see a conflict. I think that between being religious and holding such things as the theories of evolution as established science. One of the things that you did in your book is you spent a lot of time on two fascinating topics, creativity and innovation. What role do creativity and innovation play in determining man's place in the universe?
I think they're absolutely essential because the way we as humans are fundamentally different, I'd suggest, is that we actively change our frame of reference. So we change our environment rather than allowing it to change us. And creativity and innovation, they're a way of looking at things differently. We actually have to change our frame of reference to see things differently and, as a result, do something in a different way. So evolution relies effectively on us being changed by our environment. What creativity and innovation allows us to do is change the environment so we're in the driving seat. So it totally changes the way we look at things and how things develop.
Is there a difference between creativity and innovation?
And to be honest, the words are quite often used interchangeably. I think it can be quite convenient to think of creativity as coming up with ideas and innovation being about making those ideas work in some practical sense. That's quite a useful distinction. But in the end, it's all about seeing things differently and as a result, make something happen.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you've just described science and technology in about seven words, seeing things differently and making things happen. What role does communication play in creativity and innovation?
I think the important thing to think about is that, on the whole, it's an individual who comes up with an idea. But unless that idea is shared, and unless it's built on, nothing is going to happen. So communication really is the key for getting from that basic creativity to innovation, to things happening, and to science. And I'd say that's one of the reasons why writing has been so hugely influential, because it's a way of transcending time and space. You know, you can do some work now, and in 500 years' time, somebody can take your maths or take your science and make use of it because of writing. And of course, we now extend that to the internet and all that kind of stuff. But the fact is, communication is key to making use of creativity.
I'm glad you mentioned the internet, because I've been one of the things that I noticed about the internet is that the internet has made research mathematics, which I've spent a large portion of my life involved in, so much easier. Back in the 1960s, when I got my PhD, what you would do is you would read articles in journals. You might be lucky enough to find people in your immediate vicinity who were interested in the same problems that you would work with. But for the most part, you did work on your own. You went to conferences, you discussed the idea there, and communication between people who were separated by some distance, even though, you know, we had mail, we had telephone, was relatively slow, and the people with whom you could communicate were limited. Now it's amazing, because I've written research papers with people that I've never met. I published an article on the internet, and before, you know, in one of the electronic journals. And back in the day, if 50 people got copies of an article that I had written, it was astounding. And this article that I wrote has been downloaded 10,000 times or something like that. And you can see how having a tool like the internet is going to make science progress so much more rapidly than it did in the past.
I think that's absolutely right. One of the important things about science is peer review, the ability for other people to see your work and comment on it. And traditionally, again, this has relied on paper journals, on reviewers having to do that. Now we have things like pre-publishing, where people can put something online, other people can look at it and comment on it very early, and it actually can do a lot more to make things happen.
Yeah, it makes things so much more efficient. It's just, it's just incredible. How do you think evolution has influenced creativity and innovation?
I think what's interesting is that if you compare human beings to chimpanzees, that the chimps have evolved more in the last 100,000 years rather, than we have. But our creativity has allowed us to produce a kind of super evolution. So, for instance, animals might take millions of years to evolve the ability to fly, but we only took a few thousand years of knowledge, if you like, to innovate enough to make airplanes. Evolution itself, in some ways, it has become less important because of creativity and innovation. But it is still going on, of course.
Yeah. And now we're starting to reach the end of your book, and it did introduce some things that I'd never heard of. For instance, one was the British experiment involving summer time. That's not summertime. There's a space between summer and time, for those who are listening. And how does it help explain one of the dilemmas faced by rationality?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite interesting. It was back in 1968. And the British government experimented with keeping daylight saving all the year round. And it actually significantly reduced road casualties because it was light more of the time when people were typically driving. But the experiment was scrapped before it was finished, because although it had an obvious benefit, there were some people who were injured as a result of it because it was darker in the mornings. And so the choice was between the actual people who got injured and killed and many more theoretical people who were being saved. Now, rationally speaking, if you're in Mr. Spock mode, you go for the theoretical people who are being saved, because a lot more people are not going to be hurt. But the fact is, the way we deal with things as human beings isn't always rational. And from a political frame of reference, it was more important that the individuals who actually had been hurt as a result of it were made to feel that the government was doing something about it, and they stopped the experiment.
Yeah, they vote.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I alluded to this earlier, but it's a very important idea. What is the anthropic principle?
It's a strange sort of argument. But what it basically says is, we wouldn't be here if the universe wasn't the way it is for us to be here and see it. And it has to be the way it is, because if it wasn't, we wouldn't be here. And so, for instance, there are various aspects of the universe, like the speed of light, like various other constants. They're only a little bit different. The fact is that the universe wouldn't have worked in the way that it has. We probably would not exist. And what the anthropic principle says is, but they have to be like that, because if they didn't, we wouldn't be here to observe them. And at that simple level, it's not too bad, but it can be dangerous if you then try to build a structure of logic on it that says, we ought to adopt this particular scientific approach, this particular theory, because of the anthropic principle. It's pretty dangerous on the whole to build on it scientifically.
Yeah, I have to bring in here one of my absolute favorite examples in this area. It's the efficiency of hydrogen fusion. Hydrogen mm-hmm. fusion, which powers the stars. If it were 15% more efficient, what would happen is that all the hydrogen would convert to helium much too quickly. We'd have no water, and therefore there would be no life. And if it were 15% less efficient, we'd never evolve beyond stars being big glowing balls of hydrogen. And it's just incredible when you look at the way the universe is, how many situations like that actually occur with the various constants that we discussed earlier. And mm-hmm. I like the explanation. The one that's most philosophically satisfying to me is the idea of the multiverse, is that there's a huge multiverse out there, and all these various combinations are being tried in all the different compartments of the universe. And here we are in one in which the efficiency of hydrogen fusion is what it is. And so we're here, but there are a whole bunch of empty universes out there.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I must admit, I have mixed feelings about it. From my viewpoint, it some ways it feels just a little bit unlikely in terms of Occam's razor, but on the other hand, some aspects of there being a multiverse do make some kind of sense, that yes, it may be there are other bits of the universe or the whole multiverse where the laws of nature are different, and there obviously we couldn't exist. We have to be in the bits where it is okay. So it's interesting, but it's not something you can ever test. That's the thing, I think. So in a sense,
don't count
it's not
on it.
Totally correct.
Okay, you know the dangers of saying it's not something we can ever test. That's happened in science a number of times before, and normally predictions like that, that you live to regret them. But we won't hold you to it. Why is the statement everything is relative not the same thing as everything has equal value?
I think they're almost opposites, because everything is relative says we need other things to measure against to understand our frame of reference. It certainly doesn't mean anything goes, and it's not sort of vague and waffly. It's precise. It's about measurement. If we didn't have relativity, you couldn't assign anything, arguably, or many things, a value. However, that says nothing about, everything has to be okay. The fact is, in science, we often can disprove things. And the fact is that many of the ideas that perhaps use slightly fluffy ideas around relativity or quantum theory or whatever, they're just using the words. They're not really looking at how science works and doing something in a scientific way.
Yeah, I hate it when that happens, and I'm sure you do too. I'd like to conclude with what is probably an extremely important question that you don't see asked or attempts to answer in books like this. And I think it's an incredibly important one. What dangers does science present, and what dangers does it face?
I think science likes to present itself as being neutral and almost absolute. But we do have to be aware of the consequences of using science and technology. And it's a balance. I think climate change is a good example, where we've been late in thinking through the implications of our scientific progress and the technology we've developed. But at a time like now, when rationality is often being challenged with, if you like, alternative truths, I think we need to stand up for the importance of the scientific viewpoint, because science has brought us a huge way forward in terms of health and well-being and appreciation of the universe. And we need to treasure that and protect it from those who, I don't know, think the opinion of a celebrity, say, has more weight than scientific evidence. And in the end, relativity is at the heart of that understanding. So, yes, science has to be aware, and scientists have to be aware of the implications of what they're doing. And I think we're getting better of at that than used to be the case. But equally so, that, you know, the fact that it sometimes can have negative implications shouldn't be allowed to outweigh all the incredible benefits we've had from it.
Brian, you expressed that beautifully, and I agree with you 100%. I think, you know, when the history of our species is written, there are going to be some achievements that we're going to be really proud of. And I think among our proudest achievements are the discoveries of the way the universe works and how to use the way the universe works in order to enrich our own lives.
Indeed. I think that's so true. That's really, in some ways, what drove me to write this book in the first place is trying to present that picture.
Well, it's a lovely book. It's a lovely book on several different levels. And I hope our listeners will go out and buy it and read it. And I usually conclude these interviews by asking how listeners can get in touch with you if they should so desire.
Simplest way is to go to my website, which is it's Brian Clegg, BRIANCLEGG.net, BrianClegg.net, and you'll find all the information you need there.
Okay, and do you have any projects on the horizon?
There's always something. Literally this week I will be sending in to the publisher a short book on gravitational waves, the topic we mentioned earlier, because it is just a fascinating subject.
Okay, it is a fascinating subject, and you'd better have something about Stein 2051b in there. Put it in. If it isn't there, put it in.
Yeah, well, it's referred to indirectly, shall we say.
Oh, okay. Brian, it's been a pleasure.
Okay, thank you very much.
And thank you. Take care.